nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so just a quick reminder about the homework. So I know that a couple of you guys started the class later in some cases than others, so I'll work with you on the due dates for the first assignment in case you're having issues. So for the people who've been here since the beginning, like, are you in good shape on the homework, or does anybody have any major concerns at this time? Okay. So I will have office hours afterwards if you want to talk about it. But basically, the point is that it's not being graded based on, like, whether you have the best possible algorithm, but just based on, like, whether you've taken at least a somewhat reasonable approach and hopefully produces correct answers, which I think the problems are simple enough, so you should be able to kind of verify them by hand. And to those of you who already submitted it, thank you. And if you haven't, then you have a few more hours after this, so hopefully you can finish it. Okay, so now I'm just going to kind of start by recapping what we talked about on Wednesday, and then I'm going to talk about, like, some new topics, which I went over very briefly in the second lecture of this class on both root finding and optimization. But I did want to mention something, actually, in general, which is just that I want to apologize if I haven't been drawing a clear enough connection between the methods we've been using and the significance of, like, nanophotonics. So in other words, like, there are a number of techniques that I'm talking about that are a basis for research in both nanophotonics and nanoelectronics, but I haven't explicitly drawn that connection yet because, like, we will start to get to that later. But what I will try to do with, like, all the new topics from now on is try to, like, kind of give you some specific examples so that you can at least appreciate, like, where we're going to go with this long term. So in other words, like, you know, it's kind of iterative process, like, building on some, like, very foundational methods, and then it'll eventually lead to, like, research quality results, right? So it doesn't all happen in the first week, of course, but it will get there eventually. So I appreciate your patience and persistence and sticking with it. Okay, so now let me just go over, like, some of the linear algebra that we talked about on Wednesday. So the first thing we tried to do was figure out, like, what would be a good method to solve the inverse matrix problem, right? So taking some matrix that multiplies x and gives some well-known vector b. Right, so we said the first thing we can try to do is basically write that x is equal to A inverse times B. Right, so we have to first solve the inverse of A and then solve B. Now, most of you guys probably already know MATLAB, you can do that. You just write inverse of A times B, right? But what's really going on there? So that's the whole point, like, basically trying to look at what are these specific things that are happening when you enter these kind of formulas into MATLAB, and what are the advantages and disadvantages of each approach, right? So the first method that we talked about was the Gauss-Jordan method, where basically we modify this initial problem into some A prime and B prime through what we call elementary row operations. And this can involve pivoting or not involve pivoting in general, okay? So the non-pivoting approach is the conceptually simplest approach, but it can also actually be very slow in practice. So once you introduce pivoting, which allows you to move around both rows and columns, it's actually usually faster, okay? And then the second approach that we took was instead of writing A prime x equals B prime, we would actually write U times x is equal to some new B prime. Okay, so then U is basically an upper triangular matrix in this case. So what's nice about the upper triangular form is then it's relatively easy to use back substitution to solve for X. So you basically, like, if you had 2x2 U matrix, then you'd have a U11, U12, U22 times X1, X2 equals B1 prime, B2 prime, right? And then this line would basically give you an explicit expression for x2 by just dividing this by this, and then you can start back substituting. And then in the LU decomposition, we basically perform an in-place transformation of A to LU matrix, right? So it's basically consists of like the lower triangular matrix elements as well as upper triangular matrix elements at the same time, where you assume that the diagonal of the lower triangular matrix has unity entries like all the way down, okay? And we used a specific algorithm called Kraut's algorithm in order to do that in place from an initial starting matrix. And so this is like the most commonly used approach, like in MATLAB, if you perform an LU decomposition, Kraut's algorithm. And we determined that this is, obviously very good for efficiency in storage, but also it's good for efficiency in time because compared to these other two methods, the number of operations is lower. So it's on order n cubed over 3 compared to n cubed for these two methods. Another approach that we talked about, which is good for treating cases that have bad condition numbers, so basically a high ratio of like eigenvalues, is the singular value decomposition. Now, we didn't talk about exactly how to perform a singular value decomposition in detail because that kind of went beyond the scope of what we had time to talk about, but we'll probably get back to that later. And that's like a very useful method in a lot of nanophotonics, like for finding eigenvalues of like very sophisticated, large problems in which just like a straightforward LU method would probably not be well behaved. And then,
so what do you mean by large problems?
Well, it's kind of, time and machine dependent problem to some extent, like what is a quote unquote large problem. But I think you could say that, like, if you had a matrix, that had like, individual directions that were like on the order of hundreds of elements or more, then that's probably a pretty large problem, right? And so then that's where like the scaling issues and also stability issues are likely to crop up. Usually, like, if you have something that's pretty much amenable to being solved analytically or semi-analytical method, then there's no need for this unless it's, like, a very, like, artificial case, right? But the point is, like, as you go to, like, larger and larger matrices, then just by chance, it's very likely that you'd have two eigenvalues that are separated from each other by many orders of magnitude, even if, like, you weren't using any, like, deliberately obtuse construction approach.
So it also depends on the size of the problem plus the frequency at which you are trying to mesh the structure.
So
that's where the eigenvalue distribution comes into picture.
Right. Sure. Yeah. So a number of things can affect like how large is the problem, but oftentimes the most important thing, like in any kind of like research problem, is just like how accurate of an answer do you need for that problem, right? So there are some problems where just taking like a very rough back of the envelope approach might be sufficient, right? And of course you don't need numerical methods for that. But as you want to look at like increasingly subtle and small scale behaviors, then like this kind of approach becomes more and more important. Now, we also said that we can also potentially simplify some of these other methods using the concept of sparse matrices. And this is one of many examples of a sparse matrix, a band diagonal problem. And then we also mentioned that even if we don't take one of these systematic strategies for like inverting A or modifying A into like a decomposition, then we can perform an iterative improvement by subtracting basically an initial vector times the inverse matrix times like the target output of this AX equals B problem. And then we also talked about the QR decomposition, which allows us to kind of like perform a large number of rotations, which are usually like orthonormal in nature, in order to kind of nudge our A matrix into a form that's like a right triangular. And so hopefully that makes sense. And like basically a lot of these methods are going to become very important when we start looking at like band structures, like both in electronic context as well as photonic context. Now we're going to talk about finding special values, okay? And I guess broadly speaking, you can say that there are two classes of special values, the zeros of a function, which could either be 1D function or many dimensional function. And the second class is the optimum of a function, right? And so optimum can be either minimum or maximum. And I don't really make a big distinction between those because one person's maximum is another person's minimum by just putting a minus sign in front of the function, right? So it's a pretty trivial difference between the two. But in terms of finding these special values, so like why would you need to find zeros for a problem, right? So the most obvious reason is that you have a function and you want to find when a certain effect is canceled out in a problem. Like let's say that you have like a dipole emission problem, like electromagnetic dipole emission, then you may find that like you have a function which may be very complicated, okay? May take a long time to evaluate for each specific design. But then you know that this function follows some sort of continuous curve as a function of a certain like input parameter, like maybe the period of the photonic crystal that makes up that cavity. Okay. So the point is that if you want to cancel out that dipole contribution altogether, then that's like a root finding problem where you're trying to find a value that's as close to zero as possible. Okay. So, how do you go about that? So this is basically a list of some of the techniques that we can use, which I mentioned in lecture 2. And I'm going to try to kind of walk you through each of these approaches and talk about some of the strengths and weaknesses of each of these strategies. Like the most important concept in all these root finding approaches is really bracketing. And I'll try to explain what bracketing is. Bisection is kind of like the most conservative approach to using bracketing to kind of gradually zoom in on the correct answer. The Newton-Raphson method is a more aggressive approach, which makes certain assumptions about the nature of the function, and also assumes that you're, in some sense, quote unquote, close to that zero that you're interested in. And in certain cases, it converges very well. Some cases, not so much. Another strategy that I'll talk about that I mentioned briefly before was Laguerre's method, and that's appropriate for problems that are polynomial in nature. And this one looks like it could be amenable to Laguerre's method based on the slope right here. But not every problem would be. And then, yes?
Is there, on the equation on the right-hand side, I prime, numerator or denominator?
I think this is a typo. I didn't actually make this, but I should probably fix this anyway.
Yeah, because when this golden method has limitation, because when the derivative is zero, basically
right.
it's diverting. So yeah,
right.
So that should be on the denominator, like prime.
Right.
Prime should be on the denominator.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think it should be f over f prime. Yeah. Okay. So and then Brent's method is the other approach that I'll talk about. And so this basically, it doesn't assume that it's linear, but it actually assumes that you can construct a quadratic a fit within some region that's bracketed. Okay, so actually for this specific function, like Brent's method would probably be better than Newton's method, but that's not always the case, of course. Okay, so let me explain bracketing a little more carefully. So basically, like, it's not just important for root finding, but also optimization when I talk about it later. And the point is that it depends on whether you're dealing with root finding or optimization, whether you're trying to look for a sign change in the function or the derivative of the function, right? So in the latter case, optimization, you really want a sign change in the derivative, right? Which kind of makes sense because, like, as you probably know, like any kind of minimum will have a region in which the slope passes exactly through zero. Okay, so f prime of c equals zero. And that's defined as the minimum or maximum or optimum, broadly speaking. So obviously there has to be a sign change as you go in there. And bracketing is good because like you're usually guaranteed that there should be at least one solution as long as you have that sign change. There could be more than one. In case there's more than one solution within your brackets, then you may not be able to guarantee which one you're reaching, but it really depends on the method, like how reproducible that is. So usually most robust methods for well-behaved functions would always converge on the same results, but for more erratically behaved functions, which may not be nicely continuous in nature, or if you have a very poor initial guess, then all bets could be off. Okay, so you always have to be careful about how you're doing this. So, like I said, bisection. So that's like the most conservative approach where essentially you would have some function, which, like I said, is just a black box at this point. And while you see that it's drawn like this, it's not completely known in advance. Basically, what you know initially is that you have some black box and you have a bracket in which you assume that there's a root because you know that f of x1 on the left is negative and then f of x2 on the right is positive, right? So there is one sign change, so presumably at least one root in the middle, okay? And then you have to pick an x3. So here we just basically pick an x3 right in the middle because it's a bisection method. And then we evaluate f at x3, okay? The reason why we only know the function value at a couple points is because by assumption, the function evaluation is very expensive and time consuming, right? Obviously, if it's not, then you can still use this method, but maybe it's not as necessary. So here in this case, we may find that f of x3 is positive. Okay, so then what that means is we look for a new interval or bracket that's smaller than our original bracket that will still encompass a sign change. So basically, we now pick x1 to x3 as our new interval. Okay, now if we had just a linear function that looked like this, then when we evaluated f of x3, then we would have got 0, right? So then if we got 0, then we know we found the root, so we can stop. However, any non-trivial function would probably give us something that didn't pass exactly through 0 on our first guess. So we kind of gradually split the interval in half over and over again. So you can actually think of this as kind of like a binary search. So you kind of like are just gradually bisecting the space over and over again. So I know there's this game on Price is Right where you're supposed to guess how much something costs, right? So you're given some number, washing machine. Okay, I'm not a very good artist, so we'll say this is a washing machine. Have a little place to put clothes. And so basically you win this game if you're able to guess the exact value of the price of the washing machine within a certain time interval, like 30 seconds. So how do you do that? So it's usually a binary search. So you might start off with $2,000. And then your Bob Barker or his successor, Drew Carey, says, okay, no, lower. Okay, so then you say 1,000. He says higher. Okay, so then you say, okay, 1,500. Says higher. You say 1,750. Says lower. So then you say 1,625. He says higher. And then you say 87. Okay, and then that's it. Okay, you got it. So what are we doing here? So each case, we're basically splitting the interval in half, and we're using all of the previous information as kind of a boundary condition. So there's an implicit lower bound of 0 here, right? So the point is that if you were just to obviously start with 0 and then say, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right, you're never going to do that in 30 seconds. But this is a binary search, and basically the amount of time that it should take on average is going to scale as the logarithm of kind of the maximum price that you're aware of, right? So then that's like a really key distinction. So at least we know that there's like some like level of like kind of a general upper limit on the performance and the number of operations that have to take place, right? And another thing that's important here is also that you can try to bracket this as closely as you can. In the case of a washer machine, it has to have an exact retail price. Usually it's rounded off to a dollar. So that's actually an important point about the rounding, which is that, the manufacturer may find that there's a certain price for the washing machine to 7 decimal places on average, but they don't make the consumer figure that out to 7 decimal places or pay to those 7 decimal places plus a profit, but instead they basically round it off to a certain degree. And so in the case of this kind of root finding method, usually you only want to have a tolerance that's kind of like the square root of the machine tolerance, right? So if it's a single precision number, it might not be any smaller than maybe 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. If it's like double or quadruple precision, then of course it can be much higher, but it's still bounded. And you don't want the bracket to try to be within machine precision because like you're never really going to get there with most functions that are non-trivial. Okay, so that's actually a key point. Yes?
Sorry. The time consumption is reduced to logarithmic scale. You said you use the binary search. So log base 2 is probably the time it takes for this algorithm to run.
Right.
What if you use one more segment? So instead of bisection, you use a trisection search.
Would trisection be better? So, well, it's kind of a trade-off because, like, as you have more sections, then you have to have more function evaluations on each step. But, of course, you can have a tighter bound as well, right? So it becomes like, so I guess you could say, like, that this bisection would scale as like log base 2 of n, right? And then if we said trisection, then there's 2 additional function evaluations times log base 3 of n, right? So I think if you said like, okay, let's say n is equal to 100, right? So log base 2 of 100, I need to plug that into my calculator. But I think that's around 7, a little less than 7. And then you take log base 3 of 100. I think that's about 4. And then you multiply by 2, so then that becomes about 8. So that's actually slightly larger in general. I mean, it's not much worse, but it's like slightly lower efficiency, I think. So you can kind of like go through all the possibilities and then I think that bisection usually turns out to be the best. Although I'd be happy to discuss it.
There's more than one solutions in this given bracket. So this
if there's more than one. So that's one of the tricky things, right? So if there's more than one solution in your bracket, you're not guaranteed that it's going to work and find the one that you're most interested in. So usually the best strategy is to determine a bracket where you have a strong reason to believe there will only be one root. So then, of course, if there are multiple roots, then you may need to like kind of search section by section and do like individual searches on those regions. If there are many, many roots, however, then probably this is not the best method, the bisection. So then some of the other methods we'll talk about might be more appropriate. Excuse me, sorry. So like I mentioned, the Newton-Raphson method, I apologize that I think this is an error, but I need to check these graphs when I put them into the presentation. So basically the key assumption in Newton-Raphson method is just that your function is locally almost linear. Okay, so when you're in the vicinity of this root, like let's say you start here, then you can kind of extend a line from your starting point down to zero, right? If this is y, so down to y equals zero, and that this will be pretty close to the actual root value. Now, in practice, of course, like most non-trivial functions are not going to be exactly linear, so you won't hit the exact target. But if it's close enough to linear, then you can actually show pretty easily that this should converge very rapidly. And so then the number of digits that you have correct will probably increase by one for every step. So this will actually converge even faster than bisection in some cases. So you might start off with like, let's say x is equal to 2.1, and then you'd get x equals 1.1, x equals 1.04, x equals 1.044, x equals 0.0442, and then so on. So basically you're adding a new digit. So it's basically going as like log base 10 of n instead of log base 2. So it actually ends up being significantly faster for certain functions that are well behaved. But like I said, you're making like a very significant assumption about the nature of that function close to in between basically your starting point and then like your actual root. So this is only going to work for some things and fail miserably for others. In fact, there are two examples here of things that can go wrong with the Newton-Raphson method. So the first is basically that you can get stuck in a limit cycle. So you may start off with some point here, construct the derivative, and then you can see that the derivative in these like high x regions is much larger than close to the root. And so you drastically overshoot, and then you end up on the other side of the root. And you actually are as far from the root after the Newton-Raphson step as you were before, right? So this is really bad because now it's launched you into some limit cycle, an infinite loop that you will never get out of if you just use this method exclusively, okay? So, and what could be even worse is that for some methods that, where you're dealing with very, like high degree polynomials, perhaps, then you could basically construct the slope here and then, basically move yourself towards the root. But, the next step would actually, launch you into something with zero derivative. And then I think you mentioned this earlier, Zine, that if you end up in a place where you have zero derivative, then that basically launches you into outer space. So now you're completely off track and you basically are projecting not a number for your results because you're dividing by zero at this stage, right? Because like I said, the iteration is going to be x of n plus one is xn minus f of xn over f prime of xn, right? So you're basically subtracting a number that's divided by zero, right? So then that's why you end up with like this negative infinity or non-number type answer, which is kind of a disaster. So clearly, functions that are like either high degree polynomials or even like maybe third degree polynomial can often have problems if you don't have a good initial guess. I mean, clearly, in this problem, if you started like right here, right? You see right near this root, if you call this a root, or maybe you started right here, then it would be very easy to converge, right? So it's all about like, where are you starting from? So one approach might be, okay, like, you know, like we know it's not going to work like with just any starting point. So you can maybe try a few different starting points and then hopefully you find something. But then, another approach might be actually to use bisection at first, and then later you might want to use the Newton-Raphson method once you feel like you're pretty close, right? So there are a number of combinations that you can take. But now I'm going to talk about an approach that's specific for polynomials. So some of these problems, actually, it's very good for, where basically you assume that your function has a specific form. So it's basically written as a product of x minus xi, where there are many x's. So when I write this product form, then I'm saying that it's like x minus x1, x minus x2, x minus x3, and so on, right? So then we basically define these two quantities, g and h. And g is the derivative of the logarithm of the absolute value of the polynomial with respect to this independent variable x, okay? And then h is kind of minus the second derivative of that, right? So, or minus dg dx. Okay, so we first define these two things. And then basically using some mathematical manipulation from the form of this Pn, then you can basically start making certain assumptions about where the roots will be and then construct some values for the distance that you are away from a certain root, okay? So basically the set of assumptions that you make in Laguerre's method are that most of the roots in the problem starting from your initial starting point are distance B away. But one root is a distance A away, okay? And then A, by assumption, is smaller than B. Now, that might sound a little odd to assume that, like, all of the roots are the same distance except for one. However, like, if A is sufficiently small, then, like, the behavior of A is very important, so this B thing actually doesn't even matter that much as long as it's kind of like the average of all the distance of all the roots. And then the point is that you basically rewrite G and H into a form where at your starting point, like Xn, if you want to call it that, then you would allow Xn to go to Xn minus A. And then you would keep stepping this until Xn successively approaches the same value, right? So in other words, A is going to zero. So as you go through a few iterations of this problem solution method, then you can actually get very close to something reasonable, even for like these more ugly looking functions in some cases. Right. So, but this is like, again, assuming that it's a polynomial form. So for some problems, this will be a complete non-starter. So, but this is like an alternative if the Newton-Raphson method is failing.
Does it work for linear function? Because Pn of order one is linear.
Yeah. So what the problem is, like, it assumes that you must have at least a quadratic function because, like, it's saying that there are at least two roots in the problem. So if there's really only one root, then it's going to fail miserably. So I don't think it would work for a linear problem. But, of course, like, that's actually so easy to solve. You just have to be adaptable enough so that you don't rely on Laguerre's method completely in general, but you can use some of the other methods as fallbacks. Okay. Yes.
So since we can normally expand any function to polynomials, let's say using Taylor series expansion, so that means it can work for just about any function.
Yeah. So it can work for most functions, but I guess the point is, like, if you had, for example, like a exponential function or like a sine function, then it probably would not work as well if you had an initial guess that was far away from your starting point, right? So I guess like trigonometric functions are the most likely to cause problems for this approach.
Or if we expand the trigonometric function into polynomial terms.
Yeah, so insofar as like a polynomial is an accurate representation of your function, then yeah, it's fine. It works well, I think. As long as it's at least second order. Okay. So, any other questions? Okay. All right. So here's the other approach. So Brent's method. Okay, so before, remember I said that you could try to kind of combine the advantage of the bisection approach with some other more sophisticated strategy, making like specific assumptions about your function's form. So here, basically, you assume not a linear, but actually a quadratic form, okay, over some interval, right? So that's like more generalized than the Newton-Raphson method. But you still retain both the bracketing approach and the bisection strategy as a fallback, okay? And what's really nice about the Brentz method and makes it like good as a general root finder is that it's pretty much guaranteed to converge for any like reasonable function, but the speed can vary. So that's the caveat. So you're not always guaranteed that it'll converge extremely quickly, but usually it would at least be as fast as bisection. And so the algorithm is basically kind of related to what we do in bisection. But in this case, while we're starting off with some bracket and then some midpoint in between them, at A, B, and C, as we call it, instead of x1, x2, x3. And we evaluate the function, like plugging it into our black box. Then we, instead of directly looking at, like, what are the signs of all three of these, then we actually first compute these intermediate quantities, R, S, and T, that are just the different ratios of those three values, okay? And then we compute other quantities, which are P and Q. And P and Q are actually like the important quantities that we're calculating. Q is the most straightforward to understand. So actually in this example, Q is going to be negative because of the function values that we're getting. We'll end up with like each of these three things being negative. And I think P is going to be positive. And so then what that means is that we know in the Brentz method that we can let our midpoint be shifted to a value B plus P over Q. So then if P and Q have opposite signs, of course, B is shifted to a smaller value. Okay. So, this will actually shift us like very close to our target by basically assuming that there's a parabola that passes through A, B, and C and kind of fitting to, the zero crossing right here. And then once we have that determined, then we evaluate at this new point, which we could call D as in dog. And then we can use basically A, D, and B as a new set of brackets and then iterate that procedure again. And then this will usually converge very rapidly to an F of B close to zero. And then we just have to cut that off when we reach our tolerance. So hopefully that makes sense. Any questions about that? Okay, cool. So the point is, like, if you're going to use just one method, I would say Brentz method is the way to go. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about optimization. I don't know if I'm going to finish it today, but it's very important to do optimization. As you probably realize, like, in a lot of ways, like, optimization is one of the core functions of an engineer. Because it's, you know, it's easy to say that, like, there's, I guess, a new phenomenon, right? Like, you can say you've discovered a new phenomenon, but to actually make good use of it requires optimization. And if optimization is done poorly, then you can have something like a Tacoma Narrows Bridge disaster, where basically, because, like, certain possible failure modes were neglected to be studied, then it was able to engage in like a runaway behavior where it just went back and forth and back and forth under like wind loading or wind shearing and then eventually collapsed. Okay, so obviously you don't want to be the engineer that designs that. So it's important to have like both optimization in the sense of like keeping costs down, keeping material usage down, reducing the build time because like everybody who asks for an engineering project to be delivered will want it usually as soon as possible, usually yesterday, in fact. And it's very important even in like micro and nano research because although it's not a Tacoma's Narrow Bridge, in the sense of being like a very large visible structure, like it's basically the infrastructure of our modern era, right? Information age, like being able to have high speed telecommunications, having like high speed microelectronic processing, all of that is a really crucial optimization problem. How to do that as effectively and reliably as possible. So in order to understand like the different strategies for optimization, I'm going to try to sketch a general picture of like what are the considerations in optimization. And then I'm going to talk about like some of the specific techniques, which I probably can't get through all today, but I'll do it on Monday. And then we'll go into the eigenvalue problems. Okay, so let me first try to explain convexity. So a convex function is a very nice function to work with for optimization purposes. They have certain properties which are very helpful. So for example, convex functions have precisely one optimum in an open set, okay, of values that we're interested in. Right. So that immediately constrains the problem quite a bit, right? If we had an arbitrarily large number of optima, then who knows which one is the real global optimum, right? Now we don't have to worry about that. So the local optimum is equal to the global optimum here. Second thing is that, these functions that are convex are usually continuous and at least twice differentiable. And, there's a certain concept of continuity called Lipschitz discontinuity, which says that if you draw a function like this, then you can construct a cone, kind of like a Dirac cone, for example, and the function would never go outside of this cone when the cone is like right on top of your function. So if you can write the function in that form always, then that's Lipschitz continuous. Now, not every function is like that, of course. Like, so if you have like a square root function, like square root of x, right at zero, then this is not Lipschitz continuous because the slope goes to infinity right at zero, right? So those can be hard to work with in terms of convexity. But certainly if you define an interval for square root of x that starts at x equals one, until like some large value, then that could be actually concave set, which is just minus a convex set. So, and then the key other property of convex sets is that the midpoints are always going to be lower than the edges. And so formally, you can capture it by this notion of like finding a weighted midpoint position and then a weighted average of these like two sides. So that means regardless of which point you pick between them, then it's going to be less than the weighted average of these two. Okay. So that means that basically the second derivative is always positive for this convex function. If it was concave, of course, it would just be like flipped upside down. Right. And so then you just flip this inequality as well. And so two easy examples of convex functions would be x squared or alpha x squared or a hyperbolic sine function as of x. Okay, so does that make sense? Okay, cool. So, and then what kind of searches can we do in optimization? So I kind of alluded to this earlier, but there's this idea of like locality and globality. So a local search is the easiest search to do because you're basically saying that you just want to find a single optimum that's as close as possible to where you started from. And that's usually what you'll end up with by default, right? So if you don't do anything special, then you'll just end up with a local optimum. In a global optimization technique, you explicitly assume that there could be many local optima, and you usually have a heuristic that will allow you to deal with those different local optima and not necessarily assume that that's the final answer, but kind of store that as intermediate value. Okay, so then there's another kind of key distinction within the optimization literature. And there's basically both non-derivative based strategies where you just assume that you have a black box function, and that's all you get out of like your optimization problem. And then there's another one which is more derivative-based, where you actually incorporate derivatives explicitly into the search technique in order to determine the direction. Now, you don't necessarily want to do that just naively. Like, for example, the method of steepest descent is a derivative-based method, but it's not always that effective. So it's kind of a generalization of the Newton-Raphson method that I presented earlier. But it doesn't work as well for optimization because, as I mentioned, the first derivative of every function goes to zero right at the optimum. So then if you're using like the first derivative to try to find the optimum, then that's probably not going to work because like whatever derivative you started off with, which was non-zero, will then transition to zero, right? So that it's kind of inconsistent set of assumptions. So the point is like you can't just naively use derivative-based information. A sophistication is required there. Okay, how much time do I have? Okay, not a lot. Okay, sorry. Let me talk about one method, and then we will kind of skip to the end. So Brent's method. So I already mentioned that we could use Brent's method to find zeros, but it also makes sense that since it's a quadratic interpolation, that it could capture this first derivative being zero at a certain point. And so here, the idea is like very similar conceptually to what I presented earlier, which is that you set up a bracket, and then you choose a midpoint, you fit a parabola through that. And then the key point is instead of trying to determine where that parabola would pass through zero, like y equals zero, you determine where does it end up with the first derivative passing through zero, okay? And then that will be kind of your next target point. And then you can basically construct a new bracket. And so the long dashed line was kind of the first bracket, and then our second bracket is the short dotted line, okay? And then that will lead us to another function value of which is denoted by 5, right? And you just keep repeating that until your bracket range is close to square root of epsilon, okay?
Basically, you find the next point based on the first derivative to be equal to 0.
Four
found out the same way.
Yeah, so 4 is determined. Basically, when you fit 1, 2, and 3 to a parabola, then you find that this is the position, like in X, where you should have like 0 first derivative. And then 4 comes from when you evaluate the function, like our black box at that derivative, at the new X. And so, of course, like it turns out that it's actually a different place than we originally expected, which is okay. So that doesn't mean that the problem our approach has failed, but it just means that in the next iteration, we use that to like to construct a more accurate picture of this local minimum.
Does the parabolic function working for all types of the curves?
So this is a much more general technique than like a steepest descent method, because usually when we say optimum, we assume that it'll have zero first derivative. And then also, usually that means we can write a Taylor expansion about that point. So we can write that our f at x, a, let's say, is going to be equal to f at x naught plus the first derivative evaluated at x naught times x naught minus xa, and then plus the 1/2 times the second derivative evaluated x naught times x naught minus xa squared, and then plus 1/6 f triple prime x naught minus xa cubed, and so on. Right. So the point is that if we know that this is going to go to zero, then you can see that as long as x naught minus xa is a sufficiently small quantity, then most well-behaved functions where this is non-zero, should have this term dominating, right? So this dominates for most functions. Now, of course, there are some pathological functions where this will be precisely zero. And so in that case, like this method is not going to work that well.
I mean, the original function seem like to be has to be very smooth enough to have the parabolic function. Parabolic function. So what if the original function is not like not smooth enough, or it's some weird function like for example, inverse tangential or something? Can we still use parabolic fitting?
Right. So if it's a very like strangely behaved function right near the optimum, then usually this is not going to be a good method, right? So it's going to be more suitable for like nice, smooth, well-behaved, like Lipschitz continuous type functions in general. And it doesn't work well if you have a function specifically designed to have a second derivative of exactly zero right at the minimum or maximum.
Not necessarily a second derivative to be zero. I would just like, right. Some functions which is not similar to the parabolic. For example, the anti-tangent function.
Sorry, which one?
Maybe the absolute value of anti-tangent.
Arctangent?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're saying a function like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the arctangent function, I mean, does it actually have... Does it have a local minimum or maximum?
The absolute value is zero, basically.
Oh, you're saying just because it has like this abrupt... Yeah, it doesn't work that well for those kind of things, because I don't think those functions are considered to be Lipschitz continuous. So then that was like going back to the point I made earlier about like Lipschitz continuity. Right. So if you have something that has like a first derivative that goes to infinity at a certain point, like close to the minimum or right at the minimum, then that does not behave well. Okay. So then you need a different technique altogether. So we will talk about more of those techniques in the next class. So just for now, I wanted to mention that we have Martin Luther King Day on Monday, so we won't be meeting, but we'll meet on Wednesday still. And I'll kind of wrap up the discussion of optimization and then move on to eigenproblems. And this will be related to Chapter 11 of numerical recipes. So, and then if you have more questions, I'll be happy to talk about it after class during office hours. Thank you.